see they have very sharp hooked claws like that for gripping on the ice and also for gripping onto their seal prey.
Studying polar bears on the Chukchi Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 7th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Eagle residents watch with relief as the Yukon recedes.
As soon as the river started moving, it was just this collective sigh of, oh good, we don't have to wait for more impending disaster, hopefully.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Biologists just wrapped up more than a month of fieldwork on polar bears in the Chukchi Sea. The bears, who live on the icy waters off Alaska's northwestern coast, haven't been carefully studied in more than a decade. Scientists want to look at how the population is being affected by global warming. They found healthy bears on the ice this spring, but say the long-term outlook for all of Alaska's polar bears is still very bleak. APRN's Annie Fite tagged along for a day on the ice and has this story.
It's not every day you find yourself holding a microphone an inch from a polar bear's snout. Lucky for me, this bear is sedated, resting on a slushy bed of ice. We're 100 miles from land in the middle of the Chukchi Sea. Round sheets of ice are broken up occasionally by a strip of inky blue water. To my eye, it is a starkly barren landscape. But to this polar bear, it's a rich environment he's brilliantly adapted to. Eric Regeer is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He crouches down next to the bear to show me one of his paws.
You can see they have very sharp hooked claws like that for gripping on the ice and also for gripping onto their seal prey. You can feel how sharp these are.
This is a relatively small bear. Regeer guesses he's about 4 years old, an adolescent.
He's got pretty big feet. It's like a puppy, you know, big feet they have to grow into.
While the bear sleeps, Regeer learns as much as he can about him, and he measures his length and weight. This bear is about 7 feet tip to tail and nearly 700 pounds, tiny compared to many full-grown males. And Regeer has weighed a lot of huge bears this year. One even set a springtime record in Alaska at 1,266 pounds.
He was borderline obese. He was a very fat bear for this time of the year. If you look at him in profile, his belly almost scraped the ground. So he was a really fat, good-looking bear. And in general, most of the bears have appeared quite healthy.
The bears may be in good shape now, but the ice that allows them to gorge on blubbery seals is retreating at an alarming rate. Regeer says the future for all of Alaska's polar bears is grim. And this year, he's also seeing one potentially troubling sign: very few females with cubs. He says the bears who make it to this area of the Chukchi in the spring seem to do well, but they only have good sea ice habitat for a short time.
You know, we're seeing a small number of bears, at kind of a brief window. All the bears that are out here now and the other bears in this population will have to spend the summer somewhere. Many of those bears will spend the summer on land where they're cut off from their seal prey for several months and where they also face potential interactions with or disturbance by humans.
Today, Regeer is working with Russian biologist Nikita Ovsyannikov. The bears wander freely between the two countries, and both say the collaboration is critically important.
So these guys are easy to move. The 1,200-pound bears are much harder to move.
After they weigh the bear on its back, the men roll the animal over on its stomach.
Just keep rolling. Ready?
Ready.
Yes.
This is the 39th bear Regeer has examined this season, and as it turns out, his last. The sea ice in the Chukchi deteriorated rapidly this spring. Now it's getting harder to find a wide enough expanse of ice to land the small ski plane that refuels his helicopter. Regeer's last step is to draw the number 39 with fur dye on the polar bear's back.
These guys with the long, wet hair are a little harder to paint.
Each bear is also outfitted with ear tags and a lip tattoo that will allow Regeer to track its progress if he captures it again next year. It will take several seasons of study to understand how the polar bears in this region are reacting to their changing environment. Regeer says much more is known about Alaska's other population of polar bears.
One of the best studied populations of polar bears in the Arctic occurs in the southern Beaufort Sea, north of Alaska. And in recent years, the U.S. Geological Survey has found evidence for a correlation between declining sea ice and declining survival and reproduction for polar bears in that region. In other words, as the length of the ice-free season increase, polar bears have less time to hunt in their preferred habitat, and they don't do as well.
This is the second year for the spring study of bears in the Chukchi. Rosa Meehan heads the Marine Mammal Division of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. She says ultimately, the information the biologists gather will make it easier for wildlife managers to figure out ways to help the bears through difficult times ahead.
The thing that I focus on is the need to give bears as much of a break as we can during this impending climate crisis, in the hopes that we can get our hands on climate change and address it in a realistic fashion. If we can do that, then there's hope that the environment will stabilize, will come back, and that we'll still have bears there to come back and repopulate.
Meehan says one idea is to set up land refuges where polar bears may be able to eke out a meager existence for a while. But she says that's a frightening possibility to consider for a species meant to live on the sea. On the Chukchi Sea, I'm Annie Feit.
Former Department of Natural Resources Commissioner and state legislator Pat Porchot will be the Interior Department's top official in Alaska. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced today that Porchot will serve as his special assistant for Alaska Affairs. He'll work out of Anchorage and start the new job later this month. Porchot currently works for wildlife conservation group Audubon Alaska, but his career has spanned a range of land management and resource jobs in Alaska. He's worked for the Alaska Federation of Natives and for a regional native corporation and helped draft the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA. Porchot was Natural Resources Commissioner under Governor Tony Knowles and represented Anchorage in the State House and Senate in the 1980s and early 90s. Porchot will have a staff of four career interior employees in the Anchorage office and will work through Secretary Salazar's senior assistant on Alaska issues in Washington, former State Senator Kim Elton. Porchot says his focus will likely include land management issues and the hot topic of offshore development, but says his direction will be led by the Interior Secretary.
I am comfortable with what I read and hear from him on his positions, and I'll be working for him. And however, in my role, I think and hope that he will be looking to me and to Kim Elton for advice and our insights as Alaskans and people who certainly have been around for a long time and know a lot about Alaskan issues and politics, frankly.
His new Washington-based colleague Kim Elton says Porchot is well qualified for the job because of his decades working with many different groups in Alaska.
I think that the difficulty or the challenge that Pat will have is he's not just the eyes and the ears and the mouth of the secretary in the state of Alaska. In many ways, he is kind of going to be the preeminent policy point person for Alaska issues. It's difficult from a distant bureaucracy to understand what is happening on the ground.
Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich called Porchot an excellent choice for the job, and Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski called him a person of integrity. But Murkowski is voicing her concerns over recent Interior Department decisions. She put a hold last week on President Obama's nominee for Deputy Interior Secretary. The confirmation of David Hayes can't move forward until her procedural hold is lifted. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Murkowski says she's frustrated by a series of decisions that affect oil and gas development, including the extended comment period on a draft five-year offshore development plan. Her spokesman, Robert Dillon, says Secretary Salazar has pledged repeatedly to include oil and gas development in his energy platform, but so far, Murkowski hasn't seen that happen to her liking.
We're looking for Interior Department actions to more closely follow their words. I mean, you know, they talk a lot about new production and the need for new production, but so far their actions haven't lived up to that. And so we're hoping to hear that they're not going to unfairly target the oil industry and have an anti-oil bias that we're concerned that they've shown so far.
The Interior Department has said it plans to hold more than 40 lease sales for oil and gas development on public lands this year and has offered leases covering 1 million acres so far. But Dillon says the department has shut down other sales, changed Bush-era decisions on mining, and has yet to respond to last month's court decision vacating the department's Outer Continental Shelf leasing program. Dillon says there is also concern about how the Interior Department will deal with the decision in the next couple of days about the polar bear rule of the Endangered Species Act. It has until Saturday to decide whether or not to uphold the Bush administration rule that prohibits using the ESA to regulate activities or projects outside the Arctic that emit greenhouse gases. Last week, Secretary Salazar reversed one part of the Bush-era Endangered Species Act changes. Now, federal agencies do have to consult with wildlife experts before taking action that might affect threatened or endangered species. Murkowski's spokesman Robert Dillon says they were hoping Salazar would open up the decision to public comment and scrutiny before reversing it.
I think the ESA rule was the final straw, but there has been a culmination of actions by Interior that have raised concerns, and the senator, you know, had been watching carefully, had talked to Salazar about her concerns in the past, and she doesn't want to, you know, block these nominations unnecessarily, but she decided that this was the one way she could get answers to her concerns in a quick manner.
Dillon says Murkowski has not been satisfied with the answers some of the Interior Department nominees have provided to the Senate Energy Committee during their confirmation process. She recently sent a letter to Secretary Salazar with 5 pages of questions, ranging on the Endangered Species Act to which climate change models will be considered when making policy decisions. Dillon says if the questions are answered sufficiently, Murkowski will lift the hold she currently has on the president's nominee for Deputy Interior Secretary. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Whittier residents wait out the tunnel closure.
We can't get in any supplies or any tourists, so it's affecting us a lot.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
The ice jam on the Yukon River that's been causing record flooding at Eagle has gone out. The ice began shifting last night, and local National Weather Service observer John Borg says initially the water level rose.
The water level came up probably 4 feet higher than the highest water we'd had previously. And, of course, the ice, that pushed the ice into the buildings and the buildings into each other and just increased the carnage that was going on from the breakup.
Borg says the floodwater crested at its highest level yet, more than 30 feet above the river's normal height. Eagle resident Meg Helmer says the water receded quickly when the ice dam released.
All of it was pressing against the bank. We lost some riverbank downriver near Eagle Bluff. We could just see the trees being sheared off and the side of the bank falling over. But after that initial movement, about 100 yards of ice from the bank to the middle of the river stopped, and then it was just the river was receding back into the main channel again.
Helmer says ice chunks are still piled around flood-damaged buildings, but that it was a big relief to see the floodwaters drop.
As soon as the river started moving, it was just this collective sigh of, oh, good, we don't have to wait for more impending disaster, hopefully. I mean, this has been so different. Who knows what can happen, but we're trusting that that's it for now.
There is still concern that new ice and meltwater may come down the Yukon and cause additional problems at Eagle. But National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says the major threat there has passed. He says geography should ease the situation at communities downriver.
You enter the Yukon Flats and it becomes more braided. So you don't have ice jamming up in one channel like it did up in Eagle. So now we get to the area where we have multiple channels, and so you may have some channels break out and jam up while others may flow freely.
Plum says there was some flooding in Circle overnight, and water is reported to be on the rise at Fort Yukon. Back at Eagle, residents and state emergency managers are looking at how they'll handle the massive mess the flood and ice damage has left behind. Food, clothing, and other supplies continue to make their way into the community. Cars are jamming an Alaska Railroad parking lot near Portage as Whittier-bound travelers abandon their cars to take free railroad shuttle service to and from the seaport town. A rock slide closed highway access to Whittier almost a month ago, and state crews are laboring to remove hundreds of tons of debris blocking the road as soon as possible. But Whittier residents want to know, how quickly will that be? APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
It's pretty quiet on an early Tuesday afternoon in downtown Whittier. Quite a few passengers disembarked from a colorful Alaska Railroad car that had hauled Whittierites, visiting university students, tourists, and fishermen into town from a dusty whistle stop off the Seward Highway. The students haul their packs and equipment out of the baggage car. That's how supplies get to Whittier these days, by railroad boxcar, unless the supplies are too big to fit.
We haven't really started yet for the season. We're just trying to get geared up, but it is slowing things down a lot.
Larry Busman runs the local marine hardware store in Whittier.
If this time of year, we usually have a lot of people coming down to get their boats ready and go out fishing, go out shrimping, go out bear hunting and stuff, and they're not able to get here. So that makes a big difference for us. We can't get in any supplies or any tourists, so it's affecting us a lot.
The roadblock is a big problem because the first cruise ship is due in Whittier on May 16th, and businesses there are gearing up for the onslaught of visitors. The season, as they call it, lasts only 100 days. Over at the Anchor Inn, the town's venerable watering hole with a bar and restaurant in the same room, there's no shortage of conversation over Budweisers and Coronas.
Getting real hard. I just got off the phone with my refrigerated seawater guy. I run a tender, and I need work done, you know, and he's having a hard time getting his tools in here and, you know, all of his equipment to fix my boat so I can go fishing on the 14th, you know. Now it's getting right down to the wire.
Burly, red-bearded Dale Etheridge finishes his hamburger and fries.
There's already a lot of Anchorage people missing fishing because there's a lot of pot fish shrimpers out here, you know, and they've missed, you know, 2 weeks already. Well, the harbor's just really crying, you know.
Whittier has one of the busiest boat harbors in the state. Commercial and recreational boats jam the floats, and there is a 12-year waiting list for a slip. The east side boat ramp was replaced recently to accommodate traffic. Harbor Master Ed Barrett says the harbor is owned by the city and run like a business. So far, the road closure has little impact on the harbor, but there will be when the season starts, because right now, boat owners cannot haul their craft in on trailers. No trailers, no ramp fees for the harbor. And commercial fishing starts next week, too. It's frustrating a lot of people like Bill Cook.
My boat is in Portage because DOT said on their website Sunday that the tunnel was going to open up at 5 o'clock Tuesday morning, okay? So on Monday, I jumped up and got my boat and brought it to Portage, and I can't get through.
Etheridge says every day lost to auto traffic costs.
Yeah, it was supposed to be open yesterday, and then they said another week from yesterday, so, but I don't think it's going to open.
As we speak, the fast ferry Chenega slips silently from the Whittier dock, sans its load of cars, another business opportunity lost. The 14-story baggage towers houses all Whittierites. Its elevators hardly ever slow down, with kids on bikes, ladies with dogs, mechanics, and all kinds of denizens coming and going. It's also a good place to stop and shoot the breeze.
I lived here for 20 years and before the tunnel road was built, so, you know, not that big of a deal.
Hopefully they will have this situation resolved here in a couple of weeks before the cruise ships come in,
yeah.
Because that's what my job depends on.
The Begich Towers houses the city offices, too. Whittier City Manager Mark Ernest says Whittier is coping, but it's getting harder.
You know, we depend on the businesses being open and operating for a lot of our, most of our revenues. And the delay is really starting to eat in to what we've budgeted. Whittier has about a five-month season. Most of the revenues that we receive are generated over that time frame, and this has eaten up about three and a half weeks.
Ernest credits the Alaska Railroad with helping get people in and out as best it can, but he says businesses need full-time access to thrive. State highway crews did some heavy blasting on Tuesday on the overhang rocks above the slide to bring down anything that may fall in the future. The Department of Transportation posts updates on the progress of the cleanup work every evening. So far, experts called high scalers are scrambling at the area above the slide to pry loose rocks free. The work of hauling rock away is slowed, too, because the trucks are only partially loaded to comply with bridge load limits. And the best guesstimate on a road opening, a limited opening at that, is early Friday. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A boat trip undertaken in the Upper Lynn Canal recently by three teenage boys from Haines ended tragically with two deaths. From station KHNS in Haines, Nicholas Shotkovsky has the story.
Jared Henderson, Alan Dennis, and survivor Harley Whittington departed on a blustery Wednesday morning from a beach near the former U.S. Army tank farm at Tanani Point. They were intending to paddle to Skagway in a 16-foot canoe, a journey of about 14 miles. With southerly winds in excess of 20 knots, the seas were rough for a canoe, with cresting waves of 4 to 5 feet, and a small craft advisory had been posted that morning. Alaska State Trooper Josh Bentz.
With the high winds, they ended up capsizing the boat. They think they capsized about 12:30.
Dennis's brother was waiting for them in Skagway, expecting to travel back to Haines with the boys to attend a school prom there. Meanwhile, Harley Whittington had made it alone to the rugged, roadless northeastern shore of Lutak Inlet. He had become separated from both the other teens while they were all in the water. Whittington had tried to tow Henderson, who had become unconscious in the frigid water, with him, but was simply unable to swim to shore in the difficult conditions while pulling the other young man. Upon reaching shore, Whittington climbed a rock cliff to look for the others, but didn't see them. He then began to hike back along the base of the mountain that forms the northeastern shore of Lutak Inlet.
He hiked along the shore. It's a real steep beach right there. It's not really even a beach at all. It's rocky cliff, trees going right down to the water, real steep terrain. He traversed through there for several hours to get to the residence.
Whittington reached the house at the very end of Lutak Road by about 7 p.m., at which point he made a phone call, alerting family and authorities to his status.
He pointed out where he last saw his two friends, so we concentrated the search in that area, and they were located. Both were unresponsive, and they performed CPR for over 30 minutes on each, but later they were pronounced deceased.
The boys all originally had life vests on, but they appeared to have come loose on Henderson and Dennis. The event has had a particularly devastating impact on local youth. Thursday morning, a special assembly was held at the Haines High School to address the tragedy, with Whittington in attendance. Quiet stations have been set up at four locations throughout the school, with counselors stationed at each spot to listen to or simply spend time with any students seeking emotional support. This is Nicholas Shotkovsky in Haines.
Snow crab landings in the Bering Sea have been at or near historic low levels in recent years for a variety of reasons. KDLG's Mike Mason reports on new scientific research examining the crab's distribution.
Information from recent surveys indicates that the distribution of snow crab has shifted and contracted to the northwest, and larval hatching has shifted downstream of historical distribution areas in the southeast Bering Sea. Recently, a group of scientists set out to find out why. The research was presented at the most recent Alaska Marine Science Symposium by Bernard Megri from the Alaska Marine Science Center.
We know that the female range has not expanded back to the south. We know that spawning females are typically downstream of the historical spawning locations in the southeast Bering Sea.
The changes in the distribution of snow crabs in the Bering Sea are believed to be in part due to changes in ocean temperatures. The crabs are sensitive to changes in water temperature with an optimum temperature range of 0 to 2 degrees Celsius. Megri says computer modeling and observations show some interesting changes in snow crab distribution.
Offspring released in the offshore areas move mainly to the northeast onto the middle shelf where they settle and mature. Very few females are left in the retention area around the cribs, so the population cycle is maintained via these movements in the northern areas.
A main emphasis of the research into the distribution of snow crabs was to determine if it's possible for the southeast shelf to be repopulated via larval movement from the new spawning areas over the northwest shelf and slope. Megri says the data suggest it might not happen.
Migratory patterns in recent years do not support potential recolonization to the southern eastern Bering Sea, and larval transport has a northward component and no southern transport component. And there were two areas identified as major retention areas centered in the middle domain, and they have a large retention potential in every year for the suite of years that we perform these simulations. And those are Area 1, which is northwest of St. Matthews Island, and Area 7, which is just southeast of the Pribilof Islands. And most settling now seems to be occurring in the north portions of the middle domain, when it's unknown whether the stock will repopulate their historical spawning habitats in the southern areas of the middle domain.
The new data on snow crab distribution in the Bering Sea was collected by researchers from the University of Washington and the Alaska Fishery Science Center. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A new viewing guide released by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game features the wildlife of Alaska's coast between Unalaska and Cordova. The new book tells visitors and residents what kinds of birds, marine mammals, and other animals to look for and where as they travel along the Alaska Marine Highway System.
It's kind of like having a little naturalist in your backpack with you when you're traveling these areas. You can kind of flip through to different places and see what kind of history and animals are in that area.
Beth Peluso is the Watchable Wildlife Coordinator for ADF&G. She says Alaska's South Coastal Wildlife Viewing Guide is unique because it highlights features on a marine highway system. Most wildlife trails are on road systems. The guide includes information on wildlife biology and habitats, as well as community guides for six towns, including Unalaska and Kodiak.
You know, it's not just something for somebody to use when they're traveling. It's also something that we hope that communities will start using as a tool to kind of promote their wildlife viewing resources in their area.
The guide is available through the Department of Fish and Game. They also have a guide for the southeast portion of the ferry route. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Nicholas Shotkowski in Haines, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and a sustainable salmon population in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/Copper River.
And by
Alaska Communications System, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world.
Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.